Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors. Dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Here are a few questions to start us off this hour. Where is your smartphone, your tablet, your laptop? How far away is it from you? And when was the last time you used it? And what's your reaction if you suddenly realize you don't know where you left your cell phone? Is there a little bit or a lot of anxiety until you find it? If several hours in the day have gone by without checking your device for email, texts, or news, do you feel uneasy, not knowing what's been going on in the world, in your personal sphere of friends? Well, these days, most of us have some form of digital technology within our reach 24/7. My guest this hour, Michael Bougeia, theorizes that because of our reliance on machines, we will start becoming more like the machines. We'll develop the universal principles of technology, urgency, a need for constant updates, and a loss of privacy. These machine values, he says, will displace human values such as empathy, compassion, truth-telling, fairness. Michael Bougeia joins us this hour. He's professor and director of the Greenlee School of Journalism and Communication at Iowa State University, the author of 23 books. His latest, an update, actually, a second edition of a book he brought out in 2005, Interpersonal Divide in the Age of the Machine. Michael, I have looked forward to having you back on the program. Let's eat this hour up. I've got so many things to ask you, and I know our listeners do as well. Welcome.
Oh, thank you very much. I'm no longer the director. I'm a professor, so I get
very
to
good.
Work with students.
Okay. Thank you very much. We'll correct that here. I want to reach out to our listeners. How has modern communications technology changed the way you interact with your family, your friends, or at work? 1-866-780-9100. Email us, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Tweet us at IPR Talk or leave a message, reply on our Facebook page, a post about this. Michael, start off by giving us the big picture of what this book is about and why you wrote it.
Well, first of all, thank you so much, Ben, for devoting some time to this important discussion. There really hasn't been a lot of focus on how our technology are changing us as a species. And I wanted to start off a little bit with some statistics that I brought to the studio. You know, this is pretty surprising. We can take a look at this from a biology perspective to begin with. 88 days the average American spends looking at smartphones, computers, and tablets. 88 days total out of the year. It's 11 hours per day for some people. 156 days out of the year when television is added. If you factor in that people sleep, Americans sleep about 6.5 hours per night, that leaves 103 days sleeping. So 70% of our waking hours are spent looking at one screen or another. So you got to ask yourself, okay, yes, that you know, my first book, Interpersonal Divide, The Search for Community in a Technological Age, talked about technology changing our culture and how we greet each other, how we think about each other. But now when you take a look at the media and technology saturation that we have, and you place human beings in front of a screen for 70% of their waking hours, you have to ask yourself, how does that change us as human beings? How does it change if our interaction with each other is curtailed or funneled through technology? Does that change some of these ethical values? And are we slowly starting to adopt and think like the machines that we carry in our pockets, that 91% of us sleep with a cell phone within reach? And some of these stats are absolutely astounding. How many of our listeners now actually have that cell phone? Do they, you know, at their bedside, and when they reach for it, are they reaching for their partner or they're reaching to check their email? So all this stuff had me very concerned. The listeners may not know that I teach media ethics at Iowa State University. So it was very natural for me in my research to start taking a look at what are human values that are universally acknowledged and what are machine values, and then not to do a quantitative test about this, but just to bring up the discussion so that we can make decisions for ourselves and our family. I guess that's the big picture, Ben.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So talk about the beginning of, in the beginning of your book about, well, online communities being different than conventional face-to-face communities. What are the basic differences?
Well, first of all types of interaction is done through some sort of system that has been programmed for a specific purpose that may not be entirely evident to us when we use it. For instance, the book also has some experiments that you can do. One of the experiments in the book involving Facebook, for instance, Facebook, if it were a country, incidentally, would be the third largest country in the world after China and India.
Explain how you get that. The number of Facebook users is that great.
And that's a statistic that I actually had brought to the studio. But the fact of the matter is, a little experiment in terms of communities and programs that we don't even know is in the book, I suggest, start looking at sites that are not interest to you. For instance, if your hobby is golf, start looking at sites on your internet for stamp collecting. If you are a young person, start looking at Medicaid at 66. And all of a sudden, you will start to see ads that will pop up on your Facebook. I'm using Facebook as an example, but it can be any other type of social network. So we are conversing with our communities at the same time we are in one place, and those online communities are at another. Now, the last time we spoke, Ben, you brought up a very important point about cultural acceleration. So I kind of wanted to touch upon that with this question mm-hmm. of how this technology connection differs from our interpersonal connections. So right now, of course, I'm on the air and I'm going through a broadcast network, but I'm going to tell you where I also am. I am on my landline at home. I'm on my Greenlee School, Iowa State landline. I have my mobile phone. It is within reach, but it's turned to mute. I have my mobile phone on my Samsung Messenger. I have Facebook. I have Facebook Messenger, including video. I'm on Instagram. I'm on Twitter, my personal email, my ISU email, my Gmail account, my Yahoo account, my Greenlee website, my 8 book blogs, my home facts, and my Greenlee facts. I'm at 20 places right now.
Wow. Good job. I think.
Everybody should do that inventory. Ben, you should do it too. Okay. You'll be surprised at how many virtual personas that you have. So I know that, Iowa State University's official name is Science and Technology. So I try to look at some of this stuff from a more scientific perspective. Now, I'm at those 20 places right now, and I am not at those 20 places right now. Mm-hmm. It's sort of like quantum mechanics and Schrodinger's cat. I'm in the box alive, or I'm in the box not alive. We won't know. The fact of the matter is, by splitting our consciousness through all these interpersonal communities, we're getting a sense of time urgency. Everything is a rush. Everything is an emergency. So when you live on computer time, as opposed to a very central Midwest rural time in Iowa, you tend to have different perspectives on your neighbors and the world. So my book really wants to probe that from an ethical value perspective.
Mm-hmm. And it can get exhausting. I think anybody, even with half the list of virtual presences that you have, gets exhausting. We have a tweet today with that as an example, Michael. Perhaps you can comment on this from one of our listeners, Malls Dahl. The tweet says, I deactivated my Facebook account almost a year ago. I do not regret it one bit. I feel that society has become so disconnected from nature, our environment, and each other. Our connections are so important, but should be on a social and personal level instead of a tech level. Now, it's clear Malls Dahl is still tweeting. So the Facebook presence perhaps gone, but the Twitter presence still there. I have found it exhausting, and I don't know if, Michael, if you do in your sphere of friends and acquaintances, I certainly have. You'll find people on Facebook who will just drop out. Now, drop out for good, more likely drop out for a certain amount of time. And I don't know what's driving them, but it's sort of an exhaustion.
Well, let me first thank the listener for that tweet. And I'm going to tell you why that tweet is important. I understand it was done on social media, but what this listener is doing is bringing up what I'm trying to do, bringing up a discussion. There hasn't been much discussion about this since 2012. And we'll talk a little bit about that later, perhaps, about moving from a knowledge economy to a consumer economy and why that happened technologically. But the fact of the matter is that it is important to step out of the Facebook realm for a little bit. This is, I have been thinking about what my life was before all this technology explosion and what my life was as a journalist. And you relate to this,
yes,
Ben. When I started for United Press International as a wire service, I started in South Dakota, but I went to Nebraska. And this was in the 1970s. One of my investigative reports was this, and I want you to imagine this. I walked into, it's called Bank of the Box, and I think it's in Lincoln Bank, and I said, you know what, I have my card for the ATM, but I forgot my password. Can you give it to me? And the person gave it to me. And that was how much we trusted each other. Now, we can accelerate that time to about 2006. And many of the listeners might not know, but they can actually find this on Wikipedia if they want, that I was one of the first critics of technology to look at Facebook. Now, this is from 2006, and I'm going to read you, this article was the first one done on critical analysis of Facebook. It's called Facing the Facebook, and you could get it on the Chronicle of Higher Education. But I just want to read you the lead and then have you think about a question afterward. Mm-hmm. With a total enrollment of 25,741, Iowa State logs 20,247 registered users on Facebook, which builds itself as an online directory that connects people through social networks at schools. While I'd venture to say that most of the students on any campus are regular visitors to Facebook, many professors and administrators have yet to hear about Facebook, let alone evaluate its impact. That's 2006. There was a fake profile of President Joffre on Facebook at the time, and a person speaking. If Greg, if you're listening, you remember this. I contacted the president's office to let them know that somebody had used his picture and had created a fake Facebook account,
right,
speaking,
right,
as the president. This is 2006. That's not so long ago.
So we are moving at an incredible speed here. And I do remember those times. I was in a university classroom as well, and I was wondering, so Facebook is now part of the educational environment? And then it was, I mean, you'll remember, at first it was, should it be? And
right,
should we just ban students from doing any of this in the classroom? And then it was the full embrace, right?
It's true. One of your employees here was my former ethics student, Alec Hansen. And in media ethics class, I just reserve a row of seats in the back for students who are so addicted to technology that they're going to check their Facebook. So in ethics, you can't lie. So I just have these seats in the back. They're called freedom seats, and you can just play with your gadgets because you're paying me. And if you don't want to listen to me, that's your choice.
And you're not marked absent. You're still there.
You're still there.
Kind
and
of.
You can actually look up my absence. You can put Dr. Boucher's attendance policy. It's been written about before because it's like, let me use a rural Iowa metaphor. It's like sheep at the third go around in a rodeo. My hoofs are up. you can't even use those metaphors anymore because people don't even realize what we're talking about.
So okay, undoubtedly this new technology has done a lot of good in
right,
the educational sphere. So on balance, when you put it on a scale, one side this, one side that, what do you come out with in the education? Because I know you will do
okay,
evaluate
right,
in terms of family and at work. So let's go with the education.
Okay. Now, I have always been concerned about the use of technology in the classroom, but schools have invested heavily, and I want to explain why from the history of technology perspective. Now, in the 1990s, there was a lot of talk about technology in the classroom, and we were concerned then about things called digital divides, the haves and the have-nots. That led to many educators and school districts advocating for technology. I became a little suspicious about this, knowing that technology is in the boredom killing business. There's information out there that is incredibly important, that I rely on to write books, that I use in footnotes. But you have to have critical perspective and know where to reach it. Okay, so we at that time, mid-1990s, late 1990s, turn of the century, up into 2012. We're believing in a knowledge economy. Now, we had a knowledge economy because we had control over what was on our desktops. But around 2012, these major corporations, you know, Apple, Google, Facebook, Microsoft, they started doing something. They started with this cloud, and they took over control. The applications are all online. The video games are all online. And we entered the age, probably around 2012, of data analytics. There has not been much discussion of how those applications are programmed. They're programmed for profit. And we've gone from a knowledge economy to a consumer economy. Mm-hmm. And that is why technology has to be looked at very critically. There is something that you need to know concerning this, and I think it's important that you understand this, what has happened to technology and education. You brought this up, Ben, but there are some startling statistics that I brought to the studio as well. This is from the Program for International Student Assessment. From 2010 to 2016, which happens when we move from a knowledge economy to a consumer economy, United States dropped 11 points in math for 15-year-olds. We're at 41st, right there with Croatia and Kazakhstan. We're 41. Now, we held our own in reading and in science. We're 24th and 25th. We're still above the global average. But when you factor into the account how much the United States invests in public school students, approximately $12,509 per student at the last statistic I could get, $634 billion. Mm-hmm. Okay, now, where is Canada? Canada has a culture very much like ours. Okay, there's a French culture and there's an English culture, but normally they have the same types of programs and they do the same types of things that we do. Canada teens spend 5 hours looking at screens for entertainment outside of school, as opposed to our students with 9 hours. They have come in number 10th in the world in math, number 3 in reading, and number 7 in science. And they spend almost the exact same, of course, there's the exchange rate, but almost the exact same amount of money. So you got to ask yourself, how is the screen time affecting critical thinking and education? And finally, I'm going to make this pitch once again. I think at our Regents institutions, we've got to have a required course in media and technology literacy so that we understand how to use these powerful tools.
Right. And I think you boil it down in your book. You say educational diligence in the computer age has three components: know the machine, think critically, feel empathetically.
The feeling of empathy is so very important. Now, empathy is a complex emotion. On the scale of human emotions that we feel, I'm basing this on my own ethics research. It's right there after grace. You know, grace is the top emotion. Grace is based on the human condition. When you think you've done some terrible wrong and you tell a parent, and the parent, you think you're going to punish, and the parent puts her hands out for you and embraces you because she knows it's part of being human. But after that comes empathy. And empathy is the ability to feel the same emotions, the dignity, the fairness, the responsibility that others are feeling. That one feeling alone is rapidly being depleted from society. And I'm worried about empathy because robots do not feel empathy. And that's the section of the book called A World Without Why.
Facebook message from one of our listeners, Drew, to this point says, want to get those kids back to developing life skills like empathy and face-to-face communication, send them to summer camp, writes Drew. So face-to-face interactions there, part of it. Let's talk a little bit about, well, journalism, since you're at the School of Journalism at Iowa State University. You have... you quote Marshall McLuhan, known for his famous declaration, the medium is the message. Today, the self is the message. You quote someone there, I'm not sure who that was. The self is the message, and the selfie is the medium. Explain that, yeah.
Well, think about the nature of the selfie and why we take so many pictures of ourselves. And even Twitter, when Twitter first came out, I said, oh, for Pete's sake, narcissists are going to love this. What are we doing at any minute of the day? Well, the idea that the selfie has become so... The selfie was developed with, I think, the iPhone 4 with the backward-facing camera, which was a real innovation. And we started to take these pictures of ourselves in various scenes with various people. It is important to know that Facebook and Apple and Microsoft and Google, they count on you investing in yourself. Now, it's very difficult to find out the purchasing preferences of a community or even a neighborhood. But when you relate this to the self, suddenly I can data mine you. And if I can data mine you by offering you free applications like Facebook and Twitter and Instagram, they're not free. If you read the terms of service and ask how many listeners use Facebook and read those terms of service, you'll be surprised. But the fact of the matter is you take a close look at that and what it is doing to our interactions with each other. This is, and I'm not saying this is all bad, Ben. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying it's bad. There are, you know, correlations that Google made about in 2009 about where the flu was going to go next. That was a great correlation. We have wonderful science sites and math sites and beautiful books and poetry online. It's not that. It is, are we actually looking at what the internet has to offer? Or are we engaged in social networking that is data mining us to sell product? So that's what you brought up about making an ethical decision on how to use the program before you invest in it.
Okay. We have about a minute for a break. Let's talk about briefly. Let's talk about when we come back about journalism and what messages you have in this book specifically for journalism students. Will there be journalism as we know it in the future? I guess that's a question, Michael, I'll put to you when we come back, because it has changed so much. It's been searching for a business model. What will happen in the future? Michael Bugea is my guest, a professor at the Greenlee School of Journalism and Communication at Iowa State University. Interpersonal Divide in the Age of the Machine is his book. It's the second edition of a book he came out with in 2005. How technology, he says, is slowly eroding some of our core human principles, that we're becoming more like the machines we use, losing our human values. Do you think this is true? Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100. Email us, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Also, when we come back, Michael will have some tips, more tips about what we can do about it if we find ourselves in the hands of technology.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
We're back midstream in this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer with Michael Bugea. He's professor in the Greenlee School of Journalism and Communication at Iowa State University, the author of 23 books, an ethicist. His latest book, the latest edition of his latest book, Interpersonal Divide in the Age of the Machine, How New Technology, in his terms, is slowly eroding some of our core principles, that we're becoming more like the machines we use in terms of urgency, in terms of sharing private information, and that we're losing some human values. Also, this half hour, I want to talk about what we can do about it. Michael, I want to share a tweet that came in right during the break. This goes to the heart of the matter. We have many appreciative people chiming in. Here's someone, perhaps not the most appreciative. A tweet from David. Seriously? Another technophobic old person complaining about how computers are ruining everything? Ask him how many hours each day his generation spent in front of televisions or listening to the radio. What do you have to say to David?
Oh, David, you know, I'm used to that criticism. When you take a look at how I view technology, it's not from a consumer perspective. It's from a computer science perspective. I know how the app is programmed. I read the service terms. I am just as addicted as anyone else to technology. And the idea that, you know, that tweet would come with old really concerns me, because the internet has given us this freedom to actually disparage anyone that we disagree with. You see this mostly, and you want to talk about news, you see that kind of uncivil attitude, that quick judgment. Now, we talked about how values change to technology. That tweet is perfect as an example of quick judgment over due diligence, quick assumptions, usually the worst about your fellow citizen. Now, I want you to think about what Iowa was like. Yeah, I am old enough to remember the Midwest in the 1970s and even earlier. I remember how we greeted each other. I remember how we cared about our neighbor. I remember how we did not disparage anybody, and we kept our bad thoughts to ourselves if we didn't have something nice to say about someone else. I'm not saying that that was the best way to approach a situation in every instance, but the quick judgment that happens on Facebook particularly, or with politics specifically, is really dividing this country. And if you could divide people, and that really goes to a heart of the book. It's called The World Without Why. But I'm not anti-technology. I am using technology so it doesn't use you. Mm. And I think, I wanted to get back to that journalism question that you had, Ben.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when we spoke last week about social media and Russian interference in our elections, and you asked me about journalism, and I said that a lot of the social media was stealing our content, and you challenged me on that. And you said, they're just giving us a wider audience. Do you remember that exchange?
Absolutely.
Okay, well, it changed me, and I'm open to change. So I went to Facebook that evening because the station sent me the link to our discussion.
Mm-hmm.
And I put the link on Facebook, and I added a tagline. And the tagline was, support IPR because of its stance on news and fact. And now I'm doing that. Whenever I forward an article, I make sure to put a tagline that says, support this organization because it's trying to give you factual news as best it can.
Mm.
Now, the thing about journalism is it hasn't really quite adapted to the fundamental aspects of technology. And we're still struggling on how to do that. And we've been struggling now for 2 decades, so this is hardly news. But the problem is that we are continually seeing declines in journalism, newspapers particularly. I think we're losing 8 to 10% of circulation each year for the most major metro newspapers. And that does concern me. But there's great opportunity now for journalists if they understand the medium and the problems that people have in consuming reliable news.
Mm-hmm. Michael, the time is getting away from us. We're going to only get to about half the points that I had hoped to, but that is as it is. Time is unforgivable that way. I wanted to get to the other point that was in a sort of a different way brought up by David's tweet. But he mentioned, how many hours each day your generation, our generation, I conclude we have the same generation, spend in front of the television or listening to the radio. So how does this change in society that we've, if you want to put it in, 2010 through 2016 or since 2012, whatever, how does this change compare with past changes in society when faced with, going back to the telegraph, the telephone, radio, TV?
Well, there have always been, the similar fallouts from technology. In 1858, with the laying of the transatlantic cable, newspapers said that the cable magnetized the Earth and brought us closer to the sun. It's the first instance of hoax global warming. but the reality is, yes, television, Internet did not cannibalize television. Internet added to the hours we continue to spend on television. Television is as popular a medium as it ever was. So, yeah, we watched a lot of television, but we weren't consumed with 9 hours of screen time on internet. But most importantly, we were educated in a literary era. Literary eras are important for critical thinking. Reading a book is the best firewalled medium. You're not interrupted by continual notifications and such. So the ability to critically think, that's what's missing right now, and that's what we have to reinstill in K through 12 education, but particularly in college education.
Mm-hmm. Given what we have right now, how do you reinstill critical thinking?
Well, first of all, it's not that I am anti-technology. I have been dealing with, anytime you criticize technology, that becomes the label to dismiss what you're saying. What I am asking for is media and technology literacy. The difference between my checking my cell phone when I'm driving and another person doing the same thing is I may know I'm putting my life in risk and others in danger. So I try to resist that urge. So if we understand its nature, we could make ethical choices that are good for ourselves, our family, and our community. And to know that, you have to understand what technology is. It's not moral. It's not immoral. It's amoral. It doesn't contain ethical values. It is only its program. And if you don't understand the program, you can actually get hacked. You could be subject to loss of privacy. It used to be, someone said, we had 15 minutes of fame. Now that's been turned to 15 minutes of privacy, for Pete's sake. So we just need to look at this stuff.
Okay. Well, let's try to get to as many calls, emails as we can. Finishing up the hour with Michael Bougea, second edition of Interpersonal Divide in the Age of the Machine, How Technology is Eroding Some of Our Core Principles. They're being displaced with what are termed in his book machine values. Let's go to our phones and get some quick hits there. Gary in Cumming. Hi, Gary. What's the point you want to make or the question you have? Welcome to the program.
Hi, Professor Bechet. I really find your program today really, really intriguing. As a matter of fact, in 1974, I was attending the University of Nebraska at Omaha School of Journalism, and I was attending a class on mass communications by Professor Hugh Cowden, and he had us read this book that you mentioned, The Medium is the Message, by McLuhan. And we had to write an essay about whether or not we agreed or disagreed with his points, Marshall McLuhan's, and I wrote an essay that I totally disagreed with what his prediction was for the future of journalism and communications in this country, and I lost, as it turns out, because here we are, right?
You know, so,
I don't want to interrupt here, but I'm going to, because I was bothered by that tweet that you just got a few minutes ago by that young student.
We don't know. We are assuming he's a young student. It's just a tweet from...
He sounded like it because he was critical of old... But anyway, I'm going to get to my point, is that, you know, one of the problems is, you know, that I don't think that some of our young people understand is that in today's world with technology, particularly the people who are just being, you know, and they're young, so they've never been exposed to a common platform that where you have, you know, a newspaper, a daily newspaper that arrives in your doorsteps that has credibility in it, that you can trust the writers and the reporters. We don't have a Walter Cronkite.
Right, Gary. Did you have a question? We're running out of time. Please hurry up.
How do we deal with that? How do we deal with the fact that that we can't, you know, I mean, that everybody picks and chooses their own,
right,
you know, their own little, you know, neighborhood source where they get their news, and Donald Trump.
Got it, Gary. Exactly where we wanted to go. We're all, we live on these little islands. We create and exist on our own little islands of reality. Michael.
Well, he might have been reading my stuff because I worked in the Lincoln Journal Star building in 1974 and in the Omaha World Herald. You know, he brings up the point about McLuhan. And McLuhan actually had one really major contribution. And McLuhan is that pay less attention to what a source says and more attention to where he says it. A source says it in the newspaper, a source says it on television, a source says it on radio. And what he says is the medium is the message. And he was really right on that. I'm going to try to do this very quickly because it talks about journalism again. You know, right now we have something like, I did this little exercise before I came in here because I knew this question was going to rise with McLuhan. You have a TV reality star sees a nasty note by the servant on the refrigerator. She takes a picture of it with the iPhone 4, messages her publicist. He adds a mem and posts it to Facebook. It goes to Instagram, Twitter. It goes to Snapchat. TMZ blogs about it, and it's uploaded to YouTube. National Enquirer hypes it in a newspaper story. Celebrity clips the article, tapes it to the newspaper, and shoots with an iPhone 8 Plus and starts the process again. The fact of the matter, this is called mediumlessness. The idea that technology, it can morph into any other type of technology. Now, think about that old party game where you whisper something to one person and it goes to the next person, to the next person, to the next person. Mm-hmm. By the time it comes back to you, that message has totally changed. This is the problem with journalism right now and what we're trying to cope with. There's a great opportunity out there. And that opportunity, and you have to read the book to understand that the idea of the world without why. But what journalists can do right now to help their country and their citizens, and actually the globe, because we have a global economy, is start explaining why things happen.
You're saying, yeah, in the book you say correlation without causation.
That means, you know, you don't need causation or the reason why something happens to make a sale. All you need to know is that, you know, if Bechet likes hot – this was Jaron Lanier said this in his book, I Am Not a Gadget. It said, if you people with bushy eyebrows who like hot sauce on their noodles in spring and they like purple plums, that's all that matters to sell hot sauce to that person. You don't have to know why. Now, think about what we do not know about society right now. I bet you all of our listeners can tell us what's wrong with society, but I don't know if they can say why something is wrong. This is the great opportunity for the next generation of journalists to plumb. Explain to the populace why things happen. That requires investigation and fact and reputable news sources.
Okay, let's go back to the phones with Michael Boucher. Sam is joining us from Des Moines. Hi, Sam.
Yeah. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Sort of a nature versus nurture question. Are there certain personality traits that affect people's susceptibility to adopting machine values, like whether they're traditionalist or versus open, if they're neurotic, if they're adaptive, or if they're planning type?
Does that go into your wheelhouse, Michael?
Well, you know, it's amazing what the values of a machine are. Has anyone stopped to think about that? It's convenience over due diligence. We mentioned that before, but technology is in the boredom killing business, because when we're bored, and think about how many times you think you're bored. When we come to a stoplight, we want to reach for a cell phone because we're bored. We have students in classrooms who are bored during lecture because they want to do something else. But, you know, entertainment over information, over sharing, over privacy, consumption over saving, distraction over concentration. I mean, beliefs trump facts. I mean, this is the biggest problem that we have right now. We mentioned it last week as well. You can present facts to people. If they don't fall within their attitudes, they won't believe them anymore.
Right.
This is an important problem, and this is why we're having the discussion. We're not having a discussion to say technology is good or technology is bad. We're having the discussion to think critically about how we're using these powerful tools. Now, it is true that other times in our country, or in, let's just say Occidental culture, technology has caused great social change, beginning with the printing press, you know, which was 900 years before in China. But we'll talk about Occidental culture. Now, the fact of the matter is that we're dealing with something completely different. That's because of the universal access. We've gone from controlling our own applications to the cloud with these powerful companies, with these tiny sensors now that can be embodied and implanted in us, this is a situation that we haven't faced before. And then you couple that with the power of these four companies. I mean, incredible when you think about Facebook and Google and Apple and Microsoft and how much power they wield over what we think and do. It is time for us to step back even a little and contemplate whether or not our values are being changed at home. Are we impatient with our children? I know I am at times, particularly after I've been on the computer. Are children impatient with us when they play violent video games? Of course they are. The fact of the matter is we have to compensate for those urges now. If we've invited technology into our lives, and we all have, then we had better understand its nature. It changes everything it touches without itself being changed much at all. Enter into education. Education is all about technology. Enter into journalism, it's about technology. Enter into economics, it's all about the technology. So if we're going to do this, we had better know what we've invited into our lives and then make a decision on how to ethically use it.
And you can make a decision. I'm thinking about whatever upcoming family gathering you or I might have or one in the past. Who among us cannot remember some kind of gathering, a personal gathering, where people went to great effort to be together in the same physical space, and then you look around the room and you see the gadgets?
There's a chapter, I don't know if you ran across this, there's a chapter in the book about a dean or a provost during commencement, and he sat there for 30 minutes while the students got up in their life event, would be a life event on Facebook, getting their degrees, and he checked his email on stage and all public to see throughout. So even educators who are conscientious, who are, you know, who critically think, fall prey to this same syndrome.
Let me ask you a couple quick questions before we have to go. Michael, you mentioned that you are not immune to the addictive nature of the internet. What facet has addicted you the most? Do you find the most alluring?
Alluring?
Appealing.
Appealing?
Where is your weakest point?
I find none of it. I find the most appealing part to me is to be able to access scientific and social scientific websites to get at facts that I need the most.
Okay.
That is so very important. But I, too, am lured into the entertainment. I'm lured into the clickbaits. I'm just lured like everybody else. And I suffer pangs of guilt because I know I should be outside in the woods or playing with my dog or actually greeting a neighbor a little bit more friendly than I might have because I checked my email before I saw her. These are things that I struggle with. And the difference, what I'm trying to make a difference, Ben, and you've been so wonderful and giving me a forum to make that difference, is just please talk about it. Just please think about it and make those changes that you can to bring back this wonderful Midwestern culture that I've been privileged to be a part of.
What would you suggest as boundaries, as limits we should think about setting? Not that your boundaries or my boundaries are the same as your boundaries, but how do we even go about setting boundaries?
Well, one of the things that you can do is just to go cold turkey for 24 hours and then get over the addiction urge to reach for that iPad or that cell phone. You know, it's important. Go walk through the community, walk through campus. You know, I did this once. I went cold turkey and I walked through campus and I talked to professors and I talked to students and I came back forgetting what my problems were that day. Actually, this is not in this particular book, but it's in another book. This is something that everybody should try. Go through your day acknowledging all the kindnesses that have been given to you in your day. The clerk who says hello. Look them in the eye. Look the bank teller in the eye and genuinely thank them. And at the end of the day, I promise you one thing. You'll feel better and have forgotten about your worries. Try it once. It does work. My students have tried it and they have written copiously about the immense joy they get from just being kind to people.
Kind to people in face-to-face situations. Put the screen away.
Yes. And look people in the eye. It's important to look people in the eye so that our mirror neurons alight and we can really see that empathy happen again.
What about on Skype or FaceTime?
There have been actually scientific studies. It's in the book that if you were right here, Ben, and I looked you in the eyes, certain parts of our brain would light up. And it doesn't really translate through the screen. That's a mediated communication. I can't off the top of my head, tell you where the scientific study was, but it is something that I talk about in ethics class, about the ability to look people in the eye, tell the truth, feel compassion, be kind, and considerate of others. That's what I think we would like to see again.
I wish we had much more time. Michael Bugeaud, we'll have to have you back at some point. Professor at the Greenlee School of Journalism and Communication at Iowa State University. He teaches media ethics. The latest second edition of his book, Interpersonal Divide in the Age of the Machine, has been our topic this hour. Michael, it's been what a pleasure talking with you always. Thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
Thank you, sir, and thank your listeners as well.
Coming up tomorrow on the program, presidential historian Douglas Brinkley on how Donald Trump compares to other modern presidents in terms of land conservation and civil rights. Also, a Louisiana fisherman and shrimper laments the growing dead zone in the Gulf caused by runoff from our farm states. River to River is produced by Ben Stanton, Emily Woodbury, and Lindsay Moon. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.